Love to hear a little bit about your background, Justin Robinson, about who you are and perhaps where you grew up, how you got into education, whether it's something you always wanted to do. How did, I guess, Justin grow up and how did you get into education?
Thanks, Ash. Lovely to be here and to have a conversation with you. Gosh, what a kind of question to start. I think I would say, who is Justin Robinson? I'm a passionate educator at heart. And I think that predominantly came from my dad's. He was a career passionate educator. Had the beauty of being able to get home and still play with the kids out on the street in the afternoon and into the early evening and so on. But then, as the kids kind of went to bed, Dad would get out his marking or his work to do and so on. But he loved being a teacher, and the school was close, and he'd take us down as kids on various occasions as well. And also had various inspiring teachers. Mr. Steele in primary school, Mr. Franken was my maths teacher in year 7 and year 8 and year 10, my physics teacher in year 11, and my maths teacher in year 12. And that probably, led me to be the maths teacher in many ways. And I've stayed in some touch with Mr. Franken over the years. And so I certainly am grateful for his passion for the mathematics side. Interestingly, Dad was a history and English teacher and was the chairman of examiners of 18th century history for many years in the state. And all four kids all did math science. And my worst subject was English and those sorts of things. So, but certainly still got the passion for teaching. The two eldest, one went engineering, one went into science, and then myself and my younger sister both went into teaching. So I think another way I kind of partly talk about, the importance of my family is mum's gave me so much love and self-compassion for and compassion in for me. In Mum lived and continues to live with OCD, and so all my life I knew nothing different. I grew up with Mum living with OCD. It wasn't didn't have a name at that time, but at some stage Mum was then diagnosed with that and had a long journey. Living with that and supporting on the OCD support group, and I've gone and spoken at the OCD support group and so on, and that's been an integral part of my life, caring for and loving Mum and being loved unconditionally by my mum and my dad. And so it's kind of Dad's passion. Dad's still in his 80s and still running and actively writing and those sorts of things, and still proofing my words or my blogs and giving me some, constructive feedback and keeping me well grounded. And Mum's still with us, which is lovely, and still going along and so on. So my family is integral to who I am and my upbringing. My youth group church upbringing gave me the opportunity as a kind of 16, 17, 18, 20-year-old to kind of have roles on committees and to be the president of the youth group and to be able to speak and lead. And so I was always pretty passionate about public speaking. My Bachelor of Education, majoring in outdoor education with inspiring lecturers, and that gave me this kind of love for the outdoors, and also for kind of goal setting and and so on. So that's a part of me. And then just have enjoyed a teaching career. Firstly, at Trinity Grammar for 14 years, loved that opportunity and such fond memories, and the roles of being a head of year and reintroducing boarding to the Trinity Grammar School, and then 17 years at Geelong Grammar. So kind of two long stints because I just loved it. I was, schools change because people change and roles and opportunities change, and I was at Geelong Grammar as a head of house. Head of Allen House at the time that Martin Seligman arrived. And then the opportunity came for Geelong Grammar to embrace positive psychology, which became positive education. And I kind of didn't just put one hand up, I kind of put both hands up and kind of stood on a chair and said, is there a way I could be involved? And how could I kind of contribute? And then had the opportunity of kind of guiding and contributing to the pioneering of that work across Geelong Grammar's four campuses, then into the Institute of Positive Education, then into the Wellbeing Distillery. So I feel very fortunate in so many ways. It's aligned with the well-being of the family and the youth group. at Trinity Grammar School, well before the Geelong Grammar School journey, with my colleague John Carnegie, we wrote a Year 7 and Year 8 personal development program. And it's not that we were the first in any way, shape, or form, but it was kind of early days of we believed in, and we wrote a curriculum for these couple of hundred Year 7 and Year 8 boys about trying to help them, with relationships, with emotional and social intelligence, and so on. So then, when it kind of arrived at Geelong Grammar School, as staff were kind of excited by it, it was kind of this makes sense. Oh, now there's kind of even a science to this layer, which I didn't quite know about the science. I believed in gratitude and knew had a spirituality to me that was important, and the importance of kindness and love and so on. And so that's kind of a little bit about me.
Absolutely, mate. I love that. That's a fantastic story. I love hearing stories. And so funny you mentioned about your dad was a teacher. My dad was a teacher too. And sounds like you were sort of destined to be a teacher and going down that path. But for me, I've fluffed around a bit after school and eventually went down that teaching path. But it's funny, like how many teachers, parents were teachers as well. It's really interesting. You'd speak to a lot of people, and it's quite a common thing. And I don't know. It's just one of those things that happen. I think we
It's,
see what happens. We get influenced by our family. And also another interesting point is that you had teachers that you looked up to and had a really important or big impact on you, and you even still keep in contact with them. And I've heard that before, that teachers that people have I guess motivated them, or I'm not sure, the maybe encouraged them, or was a one of the reasons to become a teacher as well. So that's really, really interesting. Love hearing that story. Mate, you mentioned
And
about
I
the
think just
guide.
Ash, just on those couple of thoughts, one is that one, it's interesting that partly maybe what makes education difficult to shift and to change is that kind of people who enjoyed education are far more likely to become educators. The
True.
people disengaged in schools are very unlikely to become a teacher. I love times tables races, back in the day, because I was kind of okay at them. And so of course I loved them. And but therefore I come out as a maths teacher and I want to do times tables races and so on. But what about the people who are disengaged, and how do we learn from their stories as well? Because, I was inspired by various educators, and but want to ensure their inclusivity and the engagement of all learners. So I think that's an interesting little challenge. And the second one is that none of our four kids, Ash, have gone down the education path. So both Jeanette and I are teachers, and the three oldest have all gone down the health and kind of medical path. Youngest at uni at the moment, kind of going down maybe commerce sort of path, but none of
Well, there you go.
the four. So I think it's certainly can happen, and it's certainly been a part of my journey. And our kids are currently not on the education journey.
Interesting. And you make a really good point about that. Like when you're engaged as a student at school, it definitely can or you have a good experience, and then it could be a career path, as you mentioned. But for the disengaged, you're right. It's not necessarily something that they probably find appealing. But anyway, it's people do find their way, don't they? I think that's the important thing. Like if we can show as educators and encourage people. And this is what I'm thinking about at the moment. Like I'm doing a Year 11 talk in a couple of weeks in j late January of. Well, 2026, and it's about finding your own path, because I think some, I mean, you know just as well, or probably even more, but young people, like when they're in that year 10, 11, 12, like they might have some goals of that, what they want to be, but then things don't work out. They go down different paths and they get disillusioned a bit. Resilience can be a bit of an issue, but like everyone's got their own journey, and I think it's really important to understand. I know we're going off a bit track, but I think it's really important to highlight the fact that we do find our way. It's good to have people around you that can help guide you, but I think just like hearing stories of other people, how they got to where they are, is quite inspiring. And a bit of patience, taking action to work on the things that you want to, or the goals you want to achieve, and where you want to go. I think that's really, really important too.
Tal Ben-Shahar told a very
Mm-hmm.
powerful story many years ago that I, was fortunate to hear and chat with him about. And he was kind of talking about it, finding your purpose. But the way he explained it was, finding your bird. And the reason was he had this student who had been somewhat disengaged, but then came back years later, and he had a passion for bird watching. Ornithology, I said, maybe I've got the wrong word or something like
Not sure.
that. And very passionate and kind of got heavily involved in research and made an entire career, not just a hobby, of bird watching. And so he said, like, finding your bird and looking for your bird, whatever that kind of be for your journey. And he said, whether you've found your bird or whether you haven't found your bird, either way, you're lucky. And that was a really interesting, what do you mean I get you're lucky if you found it. If you know you want to be a teacher from year five, or you want to be a nurse or whatever it be, if you kind of found it, that does motivate and give you energy and give you some of that resilience to kind of keep going and so on. But what do you mean you're lucky if you haven't found it? And the way he worded it was because it's just great fun looking for it. Because now that implies that you're actively looking, not kind of sitting on the couch, but if you're actively looking, you kind of go to an open day, or you read a book, or you go to a festival, or to a conference, or you meet someone, or you try some different music, or whatever it kind of be. If we can say, like, how beautiful that is to be 16, 17, 18, 19, 20, 21, looking and exploring, knowing that there's a bird out there, whatever that means. So I thought that's helpful to most students that I've kind of supported in year 11 or 12, kind of most, and that might only be most by just a bit over 50, but most don't know. And so therefore, if you kind of tell them the key is you've got to know, then I think all we're doing is building anxiety
100%.
rather than either way, you're lucky. It's awesome if you found it. Awesome if you haven't. Enjoy looking.
Exactly. I love that. It's a really good way to look at it, and couldn't agree more, mate. Yeah, I'd love to get onto the Wellbeing Distillery and then just ask about some practical, I guess, practical ways that you've helped schools, and maybe some the listeners can take away some, I guess, ideas that they could apply in their own environment, whether that's in the classroom across a whole school. So, just going back to 2022, that's when the Wellbeing Distillery was founded. At the time, you were at Geelong Grammar. I'm pretty sure that you were still heading up the Positive Education Institute, or Institute
Institute,
of Positive
yeah.
Education there. So, how did you make, I guess it's a leap, really, leap from Geelong Grammar to the Wellbeing Distillery? And I know that you're partnered, so I know David Bott is one of your partners in that. How did that all come to be?
So 2021, trying to work out 2020 was what I would describe, and haven't really shared this very widely, but my most challenging year personally and professionally. And predominantly the most challenging part was making half of our team at the Institute of Positive Education redundant. And so we had started in 2014 as a little team of four of us, and had grown to a team into its 20s, had opened an office in Dubai, had opened an office in Canada, and had a growing team, some who had moved from interstate and moved to Geelong to be a part of that institute, who were very passionate about positive education and sharing that message. And in March 2020, the institute lost over $1 million of guaranteed revenue as schools cancelled because we couldn't go and do any training or delivery and so
Of
on
COVID.
because of COVID. And so, understandably, the school said, and I very much feel for Geelong Grammar. I feel for all schools. I feel for all individuals and communities through COVID. It was such a mixed bag for different people, wasn't it? The different age groups and how your home situation was and everything. But no doubt it was hard for everybody. But at Geelong Grammar School, with students, somewhere close to 1,000 boarders, somewhere close to 15 different nationalities from, students from different countries, students from every state and territory of Australia. If one person gets COVID, then you either lock down a boarding house of 70 boarders for 7 days, and you can imagine 70 teenage boarders in a boarding house that can't get out there, or you lock
Yes.
down one wing, or you try to say school's closed, but then to send people home, you've got to fly or something, and that doesn't make sense. And then if you're back home in Western Australia, you're on a different time zone, and these. So it was very challenging for Geelong Grammar School, for the leadership team and the community and the families, and to kind of some extent, the way unique aspect of Geelong Grammar School, a very special, incredible school, is that really every single student or family at that school either walk past, drive past, or fly past many amazing, excellent schools to choose Geelong Grammar. And so suddenly, once or the uncertainty of it, I don't even know if they'll be at Geelong Grammar. They might still be at home and then online, and this is now not possible, and we won't be able to go and visit them, and so on. So the school had the challenges of, student retaining students, and then the challenges with teaching staff numbers, and then in the institute because we couldn't travel and deliver. So that was particularly hard. And the school said that really we just need to come down to a small core to support our own school community, because our own school community, of course, is struggling. We need to support our parents, our students, our own community, which made perfect sense. And I continued to do that for another year or so. But then at the same stage, I kind of spoke to our leadership team and said, I still want to, I'm kind of in my last chapter of my contribution within education. And if I was kind of maybe in my 30s, I would see this through for the next 5 or 10 years or something and wait for the institute to kind of grow again. But I'm not. I'm, nicely into my 50s and so on. And so therefore that the passion to still contribute beyond one school and help, what the institute was predominantly set up for was to help grow the field. Geelong Grammar have been incredibly generous in sharing, and spreading, because Geelong Grammar is incredibly fortunate and had the resources to be able to have a Professor Martin Seligman and his team kind of live with us and stay with us and contribute and experts. And so part of the responsibility of the school to share that to schools widely, nationally and internationally, was kind of the excitement and the responsibility and the power of the institute. And so with the school's blessing, they said that makes sense, and good luck. And I think I'd kind of always felt that the institute was my institute. Of course, it wasn't mine, and it certainly wasn't mine, and those sorts of things. That it was a team and everything. But we had started it up, and I'm very passionate about it. And so, therefore, kind of we started again, and we started passionately the Wellbeing Distillery. So that was kind of the journey to then have a go at it ourselves and see where the contribution that we can make is, how we can be most helpful for school communities.
Just a quick question on that. So when the institute is this, sorry, is the institute still going when it
Yes,
is? Yep. I thought it was, I was, yeah, I thought it was, but I just wanted to make sure. So when you left, how did that work from a like an IP thing when you do it, you're at the institute and then you're going out your own? How do you manage that? Because I know that like being like in that teaching position myself and then coming out and doing growing gratitude. I mean, I didn't have any like IP clashes within the school because I wasn't really that was my role. But how did that work? Was it an easy transition out, or it was interesting to know.
No, sure. So, firstly, the institute's still going, and I still stay closely connected and led currently by Kat Lamb, a close friend and a member who's been at the institute for many years now, and many years at Geelong Grammar and taught at Timbertop and so on. It's just starting to grow again a little bit, and great news for that and the contribution that the institute will continue to make. Regarding the IP, what I was fully aware, and David was fully aware, of course, we were employed by Geelong Grammar School. So all the IP was Geelong Grammar's, and completely understandable. So we had to start from scratch. And of course, that doesn't mean you can't talk about character strengths, because they're
100%.
obviously in the public domain. But we needed to start from scratch and enjoyed that, from the mistakes we had made, from the lessons we had learned, from all that. The field continues to evolve and needs to, and in some ways, David and I feel we still keep reinventing and trying to keep learning and so on. So it was a journey, and there has been a lot of this last 4 years, the first 4 years in the distillery, of us creating. And so we now have created quite a number of resources and services and products. I've kind of spent the summer writing our brand new parent course, The 7 Habits
Brilliant.
for Wellbeing Wise Families. And that's been a real joy, thinking deeply about that and thinking the most helpful kind of course for families or for parents to participate in. So, that's how the journey went.
Yeah, absolutely. That's fantastic. It's always good to have that blessing from, like, when you've been at a school so long that you do take the, I guess, the leap, as I said, and they encourage that, because I think it's really important. Because I think from what I heard, on occasion, not necessarily just in schools, but in workplaces, like, if somebody wants to go out and have a go on their own at something, it can be a bit tricky. But I think it's such a good thing when, at the end of the day, we're all trying to make a difference. That's what the key is. And it's great to hear that the school was encouraging of that for you and David. And, like, just on that COVID situation, so what do you think, like, what's the question? I reckon the question that I really want to know is, why schools need wellbeing systems and not just programs and resources, particularly coming out of that COVID period. What can you tell us about that?
So I think every school does well-being, and probably always has, exactly what you call it. And certainly talking to my dad about the importance of relationships and all those sorts of things, of course, like, so then you kind of move into, understandably, it started this way somewhat ad hoc. Here's a good little program. Here's something that your teachers could learn. Gosh, if you get a few staff members doing some mindfulness, that'll be helpful. And on the list would kind of go. And all of them with merit. And whilst probably not all of them with a scientific, underpinning. And of course, nothing starts with a scientific underpinning.
True.
The Strathaven program that Professor Martin Seligman kind of suggested, of course, started off being designed as a program, and only after some years of delivery and some evolution, and then kind of going down a controlled kind of trial and study and so on. And, there's no evidence of the value of therapy dogs in schools. Whenever the first therapy dog went to a school, someone thought, I reckon this would be a great idea, maybe borrowing from equine therapy or other sorts of things. And then I'm sure, whilst I don't exactly know it, I'm sure there's great research around the benefit of, therapy dogs in schools, and, I've seen the power of that and felt it myself and so on. So then it makes sense being, well, kind of doesn't necessarily make sense, but logically, it's a bit ad hoc. And then the kind of concept goes, well, how do we know what's working? And there are now so many possibilities. So now the market is somewhat flooded with possible curriculums and, speakers and surveys and on the kind of concepts go of strategies and tactics and skills for well-being. And so we then go, okay, we've got limited resources, no matter the school we are. We've got limited resources, human and financial. Which ones are going to be the right ones for us to do? Which ones do we say no to? Which ones will shift the dial for our unique context? Which ones can we do internally and in-house and develop ourselves and lead? Which ones do we need some external support and so on? So then this idea of trying to do that strategically, like, whenever you do anything complex, you try to do it strategically. And even, if I'm trying to get fit, in theory, I try to do it somewhat strategically. But many people trying to keep fit just go for the occasional run and try to walk the dog and go, oh, there's an opportunity to have a little swim in the ocean. I'll go for a bit of a swim. And I can. But then at some stage, if you're a bit more serious about it, or it means a bit more to you, you go, well, actually, I better write out a bit of a program. I should have a rest day. And even the classic of a rest day for your fitness, you go, well, we probably should not mention too much about well-being in week two of term two or something. We might have overdone it, because just like you can overdo your fitness, you can overdo well-being to turn off community members, for students to be rolling their eyes, so there's a real nuance to this, successful, sustainable, systemic delivery of well-being into schools. And that our thinking is, firstly, you need a little bit of data about it. You need some data into the key, we don't call them stakeholders, we like to call them parents. You need some data onto how are the leadership team? Do they feel safe? How's their workload? Have they got trust and psychological safety and relationship? Then you check in on the educators and the support staff. How are they going? From psychosocial risk factors to psychosocial protective factor. Then you're checking on the students, how's their well-being, from their anxiety levels, their sense of hope, and so on, their coping strategies. Then you're checking on the families, not kind of so directly of how's the family's well-being, are they getting enough sleep? And that feels a bit too intrusive, and parents really go, well, that's not really, that's a bit out of your jurisdiction. But we can certainly check in and say to our families, do you feel like you belong to our community? Do you feel like you've got a voice? Do you feel that you can trust us so we can check in on the quality of our partnership? Once you've checked in on those people, they've then got data on is there, particular areas for us to work on, particular strengths for us to keep leaning into and building upon. But
But David, can
then,
I just ask you? Oh,
yeah,
sorry, Justin.
please,
Don't
no.
call you David, David Bott, but that's this is Justin.
I
Go on.
know.
Sorry, mate. Just on that, how do you? I'm always interested in collecting data. Do you have like your own surveys or questionnaires that you have internally at Wellbeing Distillery? How do you go about finding that, collecting that data? Because I think that that's a really interesting point for people to understand how that comes about.
Yeah, so we spent predominantly a large portion of last year developing a survey suite, which we call the Wellbeing Compass, in partnership with the University of Adelaide and the Resilient Youth Australia, which is the largest database of over a million students with the Australia's resilience survey. And that survey suite has six different surveys, the leadership team, the educators, the support staff, primary students, secondary students, and families. But the first half of the questions are linked to what I was talking about, checking in on their well-being. How's their ill-being? How's their well-being? How's their sense of belonging and safety and connection, and so on. The second half of the survey, around about another 20 questions, all the surveys are somewhere between 40 and 50 kind of questions, is saying, well, now also let's check in on their role that they've got. Because what we want is we want, using teachers as an example, we want educators teaching with well-being for well-being. So we want them to be well, because that's when they'll be leaning forward and engaged and enthusiastic and bring their best and kind and compassionate and regulated and so on. And then their role from a well-being kind of operating system is for them to model these well-being principles, because we know well-being is both caught and taught. And so they need to role model spotting of character strengths, the way that they talk to students and colleagues, the way they write their feedback, the way they do their pedagogy and set up their classroom, use their energy. So they're just trying to model. Whilst Geelong Grammar and many schools, and I was very supportive of it, went down the path of kind of most teachers having a role of explicitly teaching well-being, we're probably backpedaling a little bit on that because of the potential stress and distress that that can bring to a teacher who doesn't quite feel confident and competent enough to teach explicitly from growth mindsets to grit to resilience and so on. And so I think the future is not all teachers delivering that. Certainly all teachers being involved in pastoral care and having connections and safety and relationships and getting to know, but maybe the specifics of some of the well-being skills given to people who maybe one day, like I at university, I studied maths and PE. maybe in the future I could go to uni and study well-being and maths and come out,
Nice.
and therefore I could kind of teach a year 9 and a year 8 and a year 10 class well-being and my year 10 and year 12 maths class or something like that. So
Oh,
I,
totally. Sorry,
yeah, please,
I
please.
totally agree with that. I think not all teachers are comfortable with it, and from what I've seen, and in like I think it's a massive opportunity to make it a specialist subject, whether that's at high school or primary school. And in primary school, it becomes the non-contact time for the teacher. There's actually a great example of that here in Adelaide, at Kidman Park Primary. Like they've actually got a positive education specialist lessons a week. They had to sacrifice something, which they actually gave up art, but they've actually made a wellbeing classroom, and each of the students go there once a week. But I think you're spot on there. I just couldn't agree more with that point. Sorry to cut you off, but I just wanted to.
No, great. No.
Yeah.
Oh, and maybe even like it's a great story, and maybe even the PosEd can integrate some art. Our HAP wellbeing
100%.
program integrates beautiful artwork by students and by Matthew Johnston, to help engage students in well-being, through artwork and through beautiful, powerful images. So, no, I love the story and glad that you agree. And, I think it's still a step away, but this idea of, when Melbourne Uni did a 4-year research project on Geelong Grammar's students and the well-being program. And interestingly, and this is a simplified version of it, if you kind of ask a group of students, how do you find maths? And like, I remember going to our principal at the time, Stephen Meek, and I said, like, one of the problems, not everyone's enjoying the PosEd classes. And he turned back to me and said, well, is everyone enjoying your maths classes? I said, yes. And then I said, well, maybe not. But for some reason, it felt more important that everyone had to enjoy PosEd classes
So
because
true.
kind of this
Yeah.
is life. This is gratitude and your strengths. And so everyone's got to enjoy that. And so, one, of course, not everyone's going to enjoy or fully embrace any subject. And so, if you view well-being as a subject, as part of it. So, I got comfortable with that. But then when you ask students about, how much do you like science, generally you get a bell curve and many people give it a 7 or, something in the middle sort of thing. A few give it a 10 and a few give it a 4 or 5 or something. And you get this kind of bell curve, maybe with PE being a slight advantage of maybe get a few more giving it a 9 or a 10 or something. But if what we found when we asked the students about how do you find PosEd, and you can either ask the question of how enjoyable do you find it or how meaningful. But we found about the same answers from the two different questions. And both times you got the opposite of a bell curve. And so almost no one gave it a 7. Kind of half of it said, it's awesome. We love it. It's relaxing. We're learning about ourselves. We're connecting and those sorts of things. And kind of the other half said, we hate it. It's a waste of
Interesting.
time. I'd rather be kicking a footy, or I'd rather be, doing some study or something, or I don't know if I need this. And so that was fascinating for us. Interestingly, when we delved into the data deeper, no real surprise here for you that it was actually so teacher dependent. And so it wasn't half of every class, it was all of one class loved it, and kind of all of one class didn't like it much.
Interesting.
And then, of course, one teacher, passionate, sharing stories, put a whole lot of energy and enthusiasm into it. Another teacher, because it was all their capability at that time, was kind of saying, it's the one period a week that I'm so busy with different. So turn to page 7 and read that page and turn to your partner and have a chat about it and so on, and not the energy and those sorts of things. So we've always known the teacher is vitally important regardless of the subject, but it almost feels it's doubly important for well-being, positive education, whatever your school kind of calls it.
Interesting.
So that was kind of a fascinating part. I can't remember where
Yeah.
we are in our
No,
conversation.
absolutely. Like, I think where we got to, like, the surveys, and so you've
Yes.
got the data from the surveys. What's the next step for
Yeah.
schools in setting up that system? Even like for example, like say a school started the 2026 school year now here in Australia, and a school really wants to, I guess, create a well-being system. What are 3 to 5 strategies that they could implement in the next 90 days?
Yeah, beautiful. If I just quickly come back on the surveys for a
Yeah.
second, talking about then their role. So what the survey then checks in on How's the leadership team going in inspiring and articulating and sustaining a well-being vision? Because that's their role. They've got to resource it, they've got to express it, they've got to make sure they've got the clarity of that. And then we check in on the educators, how are they going modeling? Then we check on the students, are they embracing it? Are they leaning forward? Are they contributing? Are they now getting well-being strategies to navigate and manage their challenges and their sleep and their health and so on? Then you check in on the families, and their family's main role is to amplify and support the messages from the school. Because the parents are this kind of force multiplier. If you can get the parents also knowing about mindfulness and some of the strategies or the breathing techniques, and then complementing them at home, so I'm suddenly you're getting this system kind of working together. So the data from our survey suite gives you two measures for each of the partners, how their well-being is for the cohort and where the challenges are and the opportunities, but also how they're going with their key role. And fascinatingly, where we've found this is we've checked in on the transmission points, because the leaders need to transmit that message through the system to the educators through to the parents, the families come out from the other side to implement and influence the students as well. And so the leaders have got their intention and their perception of how they're doing it. But then we ask the educators some identical questions for their lived reality and their lived experience. And if we're getting a little mismatch there, that's again another fascinating point for the school to look into. So then, Ash, if I come back to your question of kind of three things kind of starting from scratch or something for 90 days. So I think the first thing, whilst I completely understand your question, is one, I don't think it's possible to start from scratch anymore. I think it probably was 15 years ago. And you know, I remember the early days, it was kind of telling schools about growth mindset, and it was amazing and it was exciting. Like now every school, you know, knows about, you know, many elements of well-being. And that's great. I love it. Love it. So one, even if I was starting from scratch in a new school, I think step one must be to honor what's happened before. The journey, the past, the stories, the examples, you know, and so an audit, but you know, more a story capturing, gathering of information, acknowledging, and so on. I think that's important for any new school leader. And we try to, when we work strategically with schools, we try to capture the historical context and the current realities. Those two kind of activities that we fill in. So then I think with some stories and acknowledging and having a feel, then go, okay, we probably do need some data. You know, I know data is challenging, and particularly subjective data, and so we need some objective data as well. And you know, we've got our attendance rates, and we've got, you know, our staff turnover rates, and you'll have, you know, our visits to the school counsellor. And I know some, you know, academic papers and research papers show a reduction in visits to the school counsellor as evidence that the program was working. Makes kind of sense. And at Geelong Grammar, we were actually trying to do the opposite. We viewed increased visits to the school counsellor was an
Interesting.
indication that the program was working, because we're teaching about the importance of help seeking, and we know the stats that in general about one in four, you know, young people go and ask for help and so on. So even that's kind of nuanced, isn't it? As that kind of, but so get some objective data. Because over the years, that'll be fascinating. And then build some subjective data, ideally across the partner groups, to then say, we're going to have to do this strategically. This is important. We're going to have rest days. We're going to have some money. We might need a new role, because we're going to have to not just, you know, resource this for 6 months or resource this for 12 months. This is an ongoing, you know, key part, because academics and well-being are so integrated, both mutually reinforcing, supporting and growing either of them are going to help one another. And we know there is still much ill-being present in our young people and in our teachers and in our communities. And so therefore, let's get some data, and then let's have a strategy. And let's say yes and no to this. And at the moment, all we can afford is this. And then let's, in 12 months' time, see if we shifted the needle. Did it actually, we wanted to see an improvement just in this. So often, and I've been in this case where you've been overwhelmed by data that I had so much of it, I didn't know what to do. And so again, we went ad hoc and we just kind of surveyed again. But so these are the five goals that we're going to try to improve this year. We articulate that to our community. We say no to particular things because we need to, and that's crucial. And the pruning principle is very true and important. What do we do less of? And then we go, here's our strategy. And just like we have a strategy for our academics and we have a strategy for our school master plan, and those, it's that important that well-being warrants its own very clear strategy, Gantt chart, strategic priorities, people responsible for them, checking in at different times, and so on.
Absolutely. That's yeah. I love that. Like the whole system approach, because I think it's, and it's not one size fits all for every context, is it? Is that fair to say? It's
Yeah,
yeah.
definitely,
Yeah.
definitely. Yeah.
So when you've got that system in place, how is it? How do you implement it at the Wellbeing Distillery? And what I mean by that is that we mentioned before about that not all teachers are confident having to really teach it in the classroom. So how do you make it actually happen? Like putting it into, so you've got the system, you've got
Yes.
what needs to be worked on. So how do you actually put it into action?
Yeah. So interestingly, and not sure whether it was wisely, but it was the way we evolved at the Wellbeing Distillery, David and I, over the last 4 years. We currently now have 13 different services and products to support schools. And the reason we went down this path, partly because we get distracted and like shiny things like other people as
Yes.
well,
Yes.
but predominantly because we grew up with this work at Geelong Grammar School, and Geelong Grammar School was always passionate about supporting all the different partners. Now, it started with the 9-day training for 100 educators and had significant professional development for educators, and every new staff member would do our 3-day course, and so on. Then we said, well, actually, okay, we then better get some curriculum to the students. And the heads of house, of which I was one of them, was responsible in teaching the first kind of lessons. So, okay, and we kind of kept evolving that. Then we said, well, actually, we don't want to forget the support staff. And at Geelong Grammar, a large boarding school with a lot of, cleaning and maintenance staff, groundspeople, a lot in the kitchen, and so on, there was a lot of support staff, many of them, potentially quite threatened about doing some professional learning in a classroom, and they might get me to kind of speak out loud, or I might have to spell something, with some challenges there. And that was nuanced how you care for and show the genuine care for your support staff and professional support staff. And some, of course, the support staff are incredibly qualified and knowledgeable in their own area and so on. Then they said, well, of course, the parents are important. And that's when we started running our parent workshops to our parent weekend courses and had more than a couple of hundred parents do full weekend courses, which was amazing kind of experience to then get that language and that connection and trust with, a large number of parents. So we'd seen that. And so we kind of partly go, well, let's kind of, write a curriculum that we think's most engaging from what we've kind of learnt. And then we go, well, because we remember being in Dubai and seeing a school delivering the curriculum of PEEK, the Positive Education Enhanced Curriculum at Geelong Grammar that we'd been, had guided and been involved in. And we were sitting in a classroom watching this teacher teaching. This is amazing. Check this out. Our team's been kind of responsible for this. And look at it. The kids are so engaged. Then we walk next door to the identical class, the identical lesson, different class, and it was a nightmare. It kind of wasn't working kind of at all, and kind of we'd always thought that it's more than just a curriculum. It's more than just a pro. It's more than just professional development for the teachers. You do so sadly because we believe in the system, as Geelong Grammar did and kind of instilled in us, and that was the learn, live, teach, embed across the system. We've then developed, as I've just mentioned, how developing the parent, we've just had parent evening kind of presentations and workshops, and now we're expanding that to a kind of a full-on course in partnership with schools. We now have two curriculums, a junior school curriculum B3 and a middle school curriculum in HAT. We have our wellbeing educator courses, the predominant predominant professional learning, blended course for school teachers, but a range of other resources also for school teachers. And then at the leadership team, as well as our surveys and our strategy work, our strategic design for well-being, then our well-being quadrant in trying to help develop a staff well-being action plan that both prevents mental ill-being and promotes mental well-being. So these become all the services. And from whilst again, there's another 100 services out there, all valuable and helpful. But so from doing a survey, you go, it looks like our students genuinely don't have much well-being skills or knowledge for them to be able to manage their own well-being and their relationships and disputes and challenges in the classroom. I reckon we need a well-being program. And we go, oh, well, have a look at this one, but have a look at this one and have a look at that one. And if you think that's the right stage for your school, you know, and then another one saying, well, the parents actually said they don't really know what's happening in well-being at the school. And the parents are saying they wouldn't mind a bit of help in trying some of this challenging aspect of parenting their teenagers. Oh, okay. Or the leadership team are saying, well, actually, our staff are so burnt out at the moment, we're going to really need to put in an action plan for, you know, because some schools we work with, we've kind of quickly found that they aren't ready to hear this talk about promoting well-being, the value of gratitude or character strengths, and on the list goes, until you at least acknowledge and show some effort to reduce our well-being. They've got nothing against, like when you hear about kind of teachers going, oh, and giving kind of the fruit bowler, it's all about cupcakes on Friday or the fruit bowl and so on. And I'm a bit over that because I kind of don't generally think there's any teacher out there who doesn't like a fruitcake, a cupcake on a Friday or a fruit bowl on the Wednesday, whatever. It's not that. It's just they're saying to you, is that really your attempt at trying to support our well-being? Keep the fruit bowl. There's nothing wrong with the school having a bit of fruit there. That's important and healthy and lovely. And make sure you've checked our levels of autonomy and change management and our workload and on that list. And I was involved in running a 3-year program with WorkSafe with 22 Victorian independent schools, really looking into psychosocial risk factors and protective factors. And that's so that became another, another product that we needed to have if a school was interested in saying that's where we see our pain point at the moment, or where our strategy or our finances, our focus needs to go at the moment, because it's an ongoing journey. It's you'll never tick off. Oh, at this school, we are well-being sorted. You'll hopefully have some things in place, but it'll be an ongoing
It's a
check-in.
journey. Absolutely. Mate, when you say, like, with the curriculum, like, for example, we'll just finish off with this, but with the curriculum, like, say, for example, the primary school curriculum. So if a teacher gets the wellbeing distillery curriculum, in that, is there the resources, like the lesson plans, for example, any resources that they need to deliver? Is that how it works?
So fascinating. And each time we kind of try to listen as carefully as possible and understand the teacher's needs, and we want to be helpful. So our middle school curriculum, HAT Wellbeing, is predominantly trying to address wellbeing through conversations and artwork for the pastoral care teacher who has one class a week and doesn't quite know what to do and doesn't quite know how to engage the students, but they've got a beautiful relationship with them. And so if you look up HAT Wellbeing, like the images addressing the 10 biggest worries of young people, they worry about their family, their friends, their future, technology, the environment, and so on. And these beautiful, there's a thought, it's very gentle. There's a thought, there's an image, there's an insight that's a paragraph, and that's all on a website platform. And then there's 24 different activities, 8 different conversation starters, 8 different activities, 8 different reflections, debates, role plays, and so on, quizzes, and so on. And what the teachers have been giving us feedback is, I feel very comfortable doing this because this is a conversation and it's about life. It's about, I'm worried I'm being ghosted by my friends, or I'm worried about this, whatever kind of the worry is. And you can see the images on the website. So that's designed for every teacher to be a pastoral care. You're not going to get the depth of resilience strategies and skills and some of those cognitive exercises, but you're going to get an engaging, curious class having a safe, healthy conversation about well-being. With B3 at the junior school level, the main feedback we were hearing was actually tell us what to say, you know. And so actually, Amy has developed the B3 kind of curriculum with a full script available for you to almost read out word for word. Now, B3 stands for, that's BE and then the number three, for belong, become, beyond. And so the belong piece is a little 10-minute activity and game developed by Playmio that many of your listeners will know. Australia is on the world's largest database of cooperative games, and our friend Mark Collard at Playmio. The second B, become, is the character strengths, and it's all in partnership with the VIA Institute. And so there's, because young people are becoming their character, and so they need to learn what, you know, social intelligence means, and prudence and gratitude and forgiveness and fairness and so on. So there are little 10-minute activities to actually develop and discuss and explore that character strength. Then the beyond piece is this idea, of course, the reason we're interested about our character is then so we can contribute and go beyond ourselves to our classroom, our school, our community, our family. And then there's a little activity linked to that character strength for that year level in year one or something. So it's very practical. You, the safety of belonging to your class, the importance of becoming, increasing character literacy with the well-being literacy, then going beyond and contributing and making a difference. So that's our primary school, and that's really quite scripted. You don't need to follow the script, but that really holds your hand, where HAT well-being is quite giving the flexibility and say, our school's asked you to do this HAT number 46, but actually, if you would like to do the quiz and not the, you know, role play, or if you'd like to do the reflections because your class is working quietly, or if you want to have these conversations, you choose amongst there. There's more than 2 hours of material. You might have 15 minutes, you might have 30 minutes, you might have an hour. Some primary schools do all of the 2 hours across the whole week and then explore the next one. So that the flexibility of that one's been the main attraction.
Yep. Awesome. Love that, mate. And I'd love to hear the, like, the whole story about how, I guess, personally, you came into education, then through the Institute at Geelong Grammar, then into the Wellbeing Distillery, and, mate, doing amazing work. And I know that you reach so many schools and educators, not just in Australia, but around the world, which is fantastic. And I love hearing stories about, I guess, people having a passion, then, I guess, delivering it to different parts of the globe. And, mate, amazing insights. I took a lot away from myself from this, and I'm sure the listeners will too. And we'll put in the show notes where people can find you. Where can people find you? And we'll put the website link in there as well. Where's the best place to find Justin
Yeah.
Robinson?
Thanks, Ash. Now, I've really enjoyed the conversation, and I am passionate about it, passionate learner, and still enjoying learning from school communities and other people, you know, leading and passionate in this field. Find me at the Wellbeing Distillery. You can actually even find me on LinkedIn. I'm making an effort to post 4 times a week and to communicate and connect with people. And I thought I wouldn't enjoy it. And so that's a learning for me, that I am genuinely enjoying learning and connecting with people on LinkedIn. So you could also find me there. So
Brilliant, mate. Mate,
thanks.
appreciate the time. Love the energy, love the passion, mate, and really appreciate sharing insights today.
Good on you. All the best to you and all the listeners. Cheers.